Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for the next 30 minutes. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the literary world. My guest today is author Lawrence Myers. His new book is a biography. It's a biography of a gentleman by the name of Edwin Barlow. Edwin Barlow was a teacher, and in fact, the first recipient of the Teacher of the Year Award. Mr. Barlow's tale is indeed an interesting one. Hello, Lawrence, and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Simon.
I've got to admit, I loved Teacher of the Year. Great book. Can we begin with a little bit about who Lawrence Myers is?
Yeah, where can I start? I do a number of things. I'm a television writer producer by trade, over 15 years in the business, writing and producing one-hour dramas for television. And the past 5 years or so, I've stepped back from that world, as it's been slowly imploding, to focus on more personal interests, including writing this book and getting involved in some entrepreneurial efforts in the consumer lending space and also in trying to find alternative means of production, distribution, and financing for television and film. So I do a little bit of everything, I think.
Hmm. Where do you call home? You're in California, is it?
I am. I was actually born on the East Coast in New York and migrated out to California, Los Angeles, about 20 years ago to go to film school. And now I'm stuck in Hollywood, for better or worse.
Mm, well, there's worse places than Hollywood. I like Hollywood.
Nice area.
It
has its advantages, certainly from with respect to the weather, but, you know, it's the traffic. We spend so much time in our cars that it... I think I'd rather be out in the fresh air or enjoying the subway of the East Coast.
Right. In the first half of the 90s, I was working for a company in San Diego, and we had a number of offices in the greater L.A. area. And I never thought I would see the day where I could navigate my way around L.A. without a map. But indeed, I learned.
You almost have to learn all the alternative routes when the one you want to take is jammed, which it frequently is.
Right. In fact, the day I remember most was I was trying to get home to San Diego from Van Nuys, and so I was forced to use the 405, and it just happened to be a Friday. And it just happened to be that particular Friday that O.J. Simpson went on his little rampage. It took me, I think it was 6 hours to get from Van Nuys to San Diego.
You'll be pleased to know that these days on a Friday afternoon, it would take 6 hours anyway, so you probably got off easy, actually, in retrospect.
Ouch. I'm going to share a secret with you.
Yeah.
Every year... I compile a top 10 list of the books I've read, and okay, most people who are listening in probably only read 10 books a year. I tend to read just a few more, somewhere around about the 150 mark,
yeah.
maybe even more. And anyway, I already know for sure this book is going to make the list.
Wow, that's an incredible compliment. Wow, that's amazing.
What prompted you to write Teacher of the Year?
Well, Mr. Barlow, the subject of the book, had a profound influence on me both as a student and thereafter. He was very influential in terms of helping me, I think, find my path in life, although in a very circumspect manner. And he was such an interesting character, as people will find from reading the book. He was this man of mystery who taught at our school for 35 years. He had a very unusual appearance with this long, shock of white or gray hair and kind of shambling through the campus with his eyes fixed straight ahead. And the way he ran his class could only be described as a cross between John Houseman of the Paper Chase and Bill Parcells, the legendary football coach. And, he had made such a profound impact on me and many other students, but what I could never get out of my mind was the fact that so many rumors and mysteries had cropped up about this guy because literally nobody knew anything about him. It was a blank slate on which people projected all of their own mysteries and rumors and crazy ideas about this guy's past. And I just couldn't fathom why is it that while the rest of us seem so intent as human beings to leave a legacy, that this guy seemed more intent on covering everything up and even perpetuating the rumors as to who he was. That was the initial spark, and as I just knew, my storyteller instinct just told me that if I started to really look into this guy's life, that there were going to be some very profound life lessons that came out of it. And it turned out I was right, much to my surprise.
One of the companies that I work with is PBS, and I preview a series for them, Independent Lens. Don't know if you're familiar with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I could really see this book as an independent lens documentary. I mean, I think it would translate so well. The guy is such an enigma.
Yeah. It's an interesting idea. Much of the I tried to frame the story as a detective story in many ways. The amount of research I needed to do to uncover whatever little nuggets of gold to piece his story together, it was very much akin to what a detective would have to go through. So the idea of a documentary is an interesting one because I think it would take on the structure of a mystery story, which is very much what it was in real life for me.
Right. Well, one of the it's a very minor point in the book. But you mentioned his shock of white-gray hair that was inevitably long, but it never seemed to get longer, and it never seemed to get shorter.
Yeah. He when I had him, is there another question you're going for?
No.
That, okay. When I, his student in the mid-80s, his appearance did seem to be almost completely the same every day. He'd wear this dark blue navy down jacket, frequently stained with coffee. As you said, his hair length seemed to stay the same. Everything about him seemed to stay the same, and yet only when looking at pictures going back 30 years do you actually start to realize that there was a change over 30 years. It was almost as if he was like a statue that came alive at the beginning of every school day, and then he turned back to stone at the end.
the research that obviously you did for this book was exhaustive. I believe you talked to hundreds of people, but I'll bet it was fun, a journey of true discovery.
It really was, because, Simon, I'm not kidding when I tell you when I started, I literally had nothing but a few scraps of paper on Mr. Barlow. If anyone went through our homes, just based on the documentation, our choice in literature, what DVDs we have, the type of china we've got, you would learn so much about us. But Mr. Barlow had nothing. I mean, his apartment, when they found it, which took months after he died, was literally Spartan. There was nothing there. There was no sheets on the bed. He had one set of silverware, almost no clothes, no books. There were no pictures on the wall. There were no diplomas. All I had were a few letters of remembrances from a few people who had heard he died. So I was starting with nothing. So the one thing that saved me and actually allowed me to write the book was he left behind a very rich oral history. All of the students and faculty that he interacted with over 35 years at Horace Greeley High School provided a lot of detail ultimately, although it took me several years. And then it was filled in a little bit by his one surviving brother and a few other eyewitness accounts of soldiers I spoke to as he had fought in the war. But it very much was this, as I say, like a detective story, in that I would hear a lot of the same rumors and myths and learn to quickly discount those I'd heard before. But every now and then I'd hear something new, and it was as if I'd found a clue. I called them little nuggets of gold, because anything that stood out from what I had already heard 20, 30 times meant it was worth following. And it was definitely one of these situations where I couldn't leave any thread hanging, because it could lead to some extraordinarily important revelation.
One of the aspects that I find curious about Mr. Barlow's existence is that clearly he was a very, very well-read man, and yet there were no books. What's your theory there?
This goes to the lifestyle that he created for himself. At a certain point, following his experience in the war, following his going to the College of Holy Cross, his desire, I think, to enter the seminary as a young man, he ultimately, I think, decided that he wanted to live a monastic lifestyle. And to him, one of the things that included was not to have any material possessions, because I don't think he cared about material possessions. To him, everything was about the intellect. That is what propelled him. That's what was the basis for his entire educational philosophy. So he was able to move from place to place with great ease, because you don't have the image of the old Depression-era hobo who throws a sack of stuff onto a stick, throws it over his shoulder, and off he goes. So I think he read these books, probably remembered every word from them, and then handed them back to whoever it was that loaned it to him in the first place.
What's the strangest thing that you unearthed on your journey?
That's an interesting question. The strangest everything was strange from our perspective. I think what I would have to say is maybe the most shocking thing that I discovered was that he had three brothers, and after the death of their mother in 1960, his one surviving brother, Albert, told me that that was the last time they'd ever heard from him. That in 1960, Mr. Barlow cut himself off from his entire family, never spoke to his brothers again. They couldn't find him. He just disappeared. And I couldn't believe that. I mean, why would anyone want to sever themselves from their family, particularly because it didn't seem like there was, you know, any type of conflict that really existed between them or business dealings that went wrong. And I think that was the thing that really took me back the most. And I think also remained, was for a long time, a source of frustration and guilt for his brother, thinking that he had done something to drive Edwin away.
Do you think this goes back to the monastic lifestyle?
I think so. I think that's part of it, that his desire to focus strictly on education and to leave everything else behind. But I think another part of it was the unfortunate revelation I discovered, which is that he was very likely an alcoholic. And I suspect that at that point in his life, he never sought treatment, and I don't think he wanted his family to be sticking their nose in his business, and feared them getting involved. One of his other brothers was an alcoholic, and I guess they managed to convince him to seek treatment. But I suspect it was to cover that part of his life up and not have it interfere or be interfered with.
Right. One of the things that came out from reading the book, and it's just an impression I get. I mean, the first section is called My Memories of Mr. Barlow or something like that, and I found it incredibly humorous.
Ah, good.
I mean, you were obviously a very scared little boy.
Well, you couldn't help but be in front of Mr. Barlow, but you know that first part, which is called the Mr. Barlow I Knew.
That's right. I'm sorry.
No, that's right. Is meant to introduce the reader to Mr. Barlow through my eyes, because there's really no other way to introduce someone who's already barely a shadow, who's a complete enigma. And I was reluctant to put myself in the book too much because I don't want it to seem like the story's about me, and hopefully people won't think it is. But in this first part, I thought, well, let me introduce them to Mr. Barlow through the eyes of this underconfident, schlubby teenager growing up outside of New York City, and the equivalent amount of terror that was put into me by both Mr. Barlow and just everyday life in high school.
Right.
It was you know, I think we all have our memories of high school, and I certainly have good ones, but I suppose terror is probably a good way to describe my experience as well.
I'll tell you a story. I was reading the book and I was laughing so hard. I mean, my wife was staring at me out of the window. You know, she thought I'd come totally unhinged.
Yeah, well, I know what you're referring to, because Mr. Barlow has certainly had a way of conducting his classes that I don't think anyone would get away with today.
Right.
You know, for him, and I assume this is where you're going with the question. When you were in Mr. Barlow's class, you were to be 110% focused on what was going on. As our vice principal Larry Breen said, his classes were not merely invitations to learn; they were command performances. So when you were in that classroom, you better be paying attention. And his style was very self-directed. He would send people to the board to write out a problem or begin to solve it, and direct them from the back of the room on what to do next and so on. And of course, people would invariably make some sort of error, some of them just foolish ones or silly ones, like drawing a diagonal line instead of a horizontal one for a fraction. And others might be a little more serious, like forgetting how to multiply 5 times 6, something. Regardless, Mr. Barlow would chastise the student who made this error. And the way he did it might range anywhere from with a tone of jest, calling them a blockhead, which usually meant that he liked you and knew you were being a little bit stupid or intellectually lazy, as he said, to just full-blown, truly put-upon rages, which generally people were subjected to if they disrespected him or disrespected the process of learning. And the comments that he would throw out, calling people morons or clods or vegetables for even the slightest mistake, you couldn't help, I think, but on the inside laugh half the time, because you knew he was getting on you for something that a mistake you made that you shouldn't have made if you'd really been on the ball.
Right.
One of his more classic punishments for a student who had left a piece of paper on the floor of the classroom was to write the word litter 2,000 times and then come in the next day and recite the word litter 2,000 times. You can imagine, probably sounds pretty ridiculous after, you know, the first 200 recitations. But that was the great, as somebody said, you know, I can't imagine Mr. Barlow being destructive, and if they did, then they missed the great joke, because in many, many circumstances, I think he was really trying to drill home to us, pay attention, this is serious business.
Right. What I noticed, I'll go back to my where I started this, you as a pupil of Mr. Barlow's was hugely funny, but your relationship with him continued after you graduated from high school, and I see a very distinct change. Suddenly, he began to treat you more as a peer. Would that be correct?
Yeah, I think so. He was very unusual in that he would never offer to students and say, I'm here after school every day if you need help or anything else. If you had Mr. Barlow, if you were even awake, you knew he was always in his classroom after school until 6 o'clock every day. So those students who had the courage and the fortitude to go and pay a visit to him were rewarded, because there you would learn how truly caring and generous he was. I mean, his love for students was just endless. I'd heard rumors that he would visit students in the hospital to catch them up on the day's lesson that they'd missed, that people had come back to him when they were having trouble in college. And as I discovered, all of this was in fact true. And in my particular case, I was struggling with some physics and calculus when I was in my first year at Cornell, and I snuck out like a low-rent Steve McQueen from the Cornell campus to visit him for over the weekend to get some help with things that were really vexing me. And I'd be sure to visit him once over every summer, and he was kind enough to accept an invitation to dinner a couple of times. And we started to discuss things of greater import. And in retrospect, through my research, I realized that his whole philosophy of education was to help people find their vocation, find why they were put on this earth and what they were meant to do with their lives. So he took those relationships for those who came to him very seriously, because he felt it was his duty.
His teaching methods, as you mentioned earlier, were a little unorthodox. And I doubt that any teacher today could act like Mr. Barlow without incurring the wrath of parents and the local board of education. What is your view of the state of play in today's schools?
Yeah, it's a very interesting situation we have. And although I can only speak from local experience in Los Angeles, having two young children now in the school system there and being very aware of the situation, I think first and foremost, we're treating, I think, students in general with kid gloves, particularly, I think, in high school. Parents are so litigious these days. There's such a high degree of political correctness that Mr. Barlow would never get away with what he did then today. And that would be, I think, to the student's detriment, because despite these tactics, which a lot of people may hear and think, what, the guy's a sadist, he's crazy, I'd never put my kid in that class. The truth was, if you didn't want to be in his class, you could transfer out. And if you were there for advanced placement calculus, it's because you wanted to earn college credit. So you better be tough. And that is that's the one thing to remember about his particular tactics. But it certainly raises an interesting question about what a teacher's job in the classroom should be. Yeah, go ahead.
This doesn't often happen in interviews. People tend to just sit back and listen. But I do have a caller on the line, and I'm going to introduce them and see what their question is. Caller from the 206 area code, do you have a question for us? No, apparently not.
I was so excited. Somebody from Washington State calling.
Oh, really? Well, if the caller in the 206 area code does want to talk, there is a little thing you can hit, and I will notice a flag on my switchboard. Okay, let's go back to what we were talking about. As I said, I lived in San Diego for a number of years, and we enrolled our two young children in the local elementary school, and my wife, she's now my ex-wife, asked when we were going through the enrollment process, do the kids come home for lunch, seeing as we were about two blocks away from the school. And the lady in the office laughed and said, good Lord, no. If we let them come home from lunch, half of them wouldn't come back.
It's, you know, I can't speak to the state of the San Diego school system, but one thing is for certain. We're in big trouble here in California, despite the fact that something like 40% of the state's budget is mandated to go to education. We are 50th in the nation in schools. We are facing teacher employment cuts, partly because I think the teachers' union may need to scale back what it is that they're asking for, but primarily I think it's because of absolutely unforgivable mismanagement of the budgetary situation in these schools. There's no excuse to have $40 billion a year going to California schools and have it be wasted in such a way that we're last in the nation. And I blame the legislature, I blame the governor, and something needs to be done if California is emblematic of the rest of the country in terms of the state of education. So that's my soapbox rant for today.
Okay. Is Teacher of the Year your first foray into book writing?
It is, although I can't say I'm going to spend another 10 years writing another book, that's for sure. I do have another book coming out in the spring, which is a series of very fascinating discussions with the creators of one-hour television shows. And the book's title, which is called Fame, Fortune, Awards, and Fan Clubs, How Average Schmoes Got All This Writing for Television and You Can Too, is meant to kind of bring the average television viewer into a world of what actually goes on behind the scenes in writing and creating a show and the conflicts that occur between art and commerce. And it's a pretty fascinating exploration. So anyone who's interested in television, I think, should also find that book of interest.
Oh, I can't wait. Put me down for a copy.
Yeah, you'll get your autographed copy as soon as it comes out.
Great. I talk to a lot of first-time authors, and a frequent complaint I hear is about how ugly the entire publishing industry is. Agents and finding a publisher and rejection letters, and it goes on and on. What were your experiences?
Well, having experienced a great deal of rejection in Hollywood, I was prepared for the publishing world. But the fact that it had taken me so long to write this book, and I didn't want to wait another 2 or 3 years to have to go through that whole process. So I very quickly ran it past a couple of agents that I knew that were low-hanging fruit, that went to my high school, that might have interest, not expecting them to have interest because, for a variety of reasons, I knew they would say, it's a tough sell, which is what they said. Knowing that, I decided I would choose maybe a dozen independent publishing houses that I thought might be interested in the book. And lo and behold, I found one that was run by someone who might be as equally eccentric as Mr. Barlow in a Midwestern company called H.H. & Sons. And the guy just who runs the publisher just loves books, and as an entrepreneur himself, felt that exactly what you had said, the publishing business is so mercurial that he just wanted to find great authors with unique voices that he could get behind. And rather than be the greedy publishing company, he had so much money from all of his entrepreneurial efforts, he basically flipped the compensation arrangement so that the author is the one who takes home the lion's share of revenue. So that turned out to be a great experience, and one I would do again. I think the book publishing business is, you know, it's been in trouble for a long time. They leave a lot of money on the table. It's very much the same problem that movie studios have in terms of making all their money from the blockbusters, while all the other smaller titles probably generate losses.
Right. Where can people find their own copy of Teacher of the Year?
Well, they can go to either the website, which is MrBarlow.com, MisterBarlow, all one word. There they can either get a link to a paperback at Amazon.com, which they could go to directly, or they can get an autographed hardcover, which I fulfill directly for people. And if you're going to go to Amazon.com, just do a search under Edwin Barlow, for some reason Teacher of the Year. I guess there are some other books out there called that, but I'm sure they aren't nearly as good.
I'm inclined to agree. I do think that your book is an absolute cracking read. What sort of feedback are you getting from people?
Well, it's been really wonderful. We did what sort of is called a platform release, which is to focus at first on my high school alumni and Chappaqua, New York, where the school is. And I probably had two or three dozen really heartfelt, wonderful notes telling me how much, not just that they enjoyed the book, but that they got to know Mr. Barlow, who they had or they had heard of. And it's the kind of notes I think every author would just love to receive. It just, not only does it make you feel good, but that the work touched somebody's lives, and there's no greater compliment than that.
Lawrence, unfortunately, our time is up, but this has been a delightful talk, and I do hope that we can chat again soon.
Likewise, Simon. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, absolutely, my pleasure. And I'll say this to all of our listeners. This is one book that you do not want to miss. So head on over to www.mrbarlow.com or go to Amazon and order yourself a copy. You will not regret it. This is Simon Barrett. Wishing everyone a great day, and I'm sure we will all talk again soon. Lawrence, pleasure. Have a wonderful day.
You too.